Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
If you miss some of our conversations day to day, our in-depth discussions, the segments like the one we just did with Ginger Charles, you can always find them on my podcast and listen when it's right for you. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Becker Furniture World, a full-service furniture store featuring billiards and games at all 7 locations. You can find billiard tables, bars, stools, and more. More information at BeckerFurnitureWorld.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. It is Thread Week on the show with a week-long focus on terrific reading. Today, books about American and world history that will give us some perspective on our roiled and rowdy political scene. When Thread writer Tracy Mumford asked a physicist-turned-bookseller about the book he'd hand-sell to his customers, he told her this.
I would recommend for anyone who is not turned off totally by politics at this moment, reading his new biography of George Herbert Walker Bush. Regardless of how you feel about politicians, you have to admire a man who was born to great wealth, yet served his country in the war, who had a feeling that modesty and temperament were important, who was gracious in losing and magnanimous in winning.
That's Bruce Delaney of Rediscovered Books in Boise, Idaho. And that's what I want you to think about, too. Are there historical memoirs, biographies, fiction or nonfiction books that are must-reads for the political era that we're living through? Is there a book that might give us all some common perspective? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. I'm seeing a lot about John Adams on Twitter here. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. And Steph Curtis is at nprnews.org/live. Steph, I think we're going to hear, and this will be great, we'll hear the tried and true kind of biographies that stand above, the Adams, the Benjamin Franklins. But I also want our listeners to think a little more broadly on that, too. Just don't go back to the founding father biographies.
Please.
Change it up a little bit.
Yes.
We'll have a list on the thread.
We will.
Right after the show. Carlos Lozada is with us. He's nonfiction book critic at The Washington Post and with us from D.C. Carlos, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again. Ah, we'll see if Carlos is there. We're not talking to him yet. David Yulin is with us. He's an assistant professor of English at USC and a contributing editor to Lit Hub, and he's with us from L.A. David, welcome. It's good to talk to you again.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so David, I think Bruce Delaney in Boise has it right because the long view is really valuable in a moment when Americans tend to think nothing like this has ever happened before. Well, of course it has.
I actually think nothing like this has ever happened before, exactly.
Come on, David, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the election cycle, obviously things like this have happened before, but I think that we're looking at we don't know what's going to happen, but I think that we're looking at certainly things like the appointment of Steve Bannon and a lot of the rhetoric that came out of the election, the idea of mass deportations and a registry for Muslims. Whether or not those things actually are enacted, we've never seen a candidate. We've certainly seen fringe candidates float sort of ideas like that, but we've never seen a candidate, even who was the nominee of a major party, let alone win an election, run on and win on those kind of ideas. So I think it's important, two things. I mean, I think, one, yes, it is certainly, the election is a result of democratic process and, was not rigged, obviously, in terms of, was played fairly according to its own rules. But I'm not sure what happens now in terms of the person that the election has yielded. So I think it's a two-way street. Yes, we've had contentious elections. We've had
deep divisions.
Whatever side of the spectrum you stand on ideologically, we've had difficult people elected into the office. I think that the, you know, the incoming president may be sui generis in terms of his lack of understanding of basic American institutions.
So, Carlos, before you dropped, I said to David, you know, I think the long view, we had this bookseller in Idaho who was talking about a biography of George H.W. Bush, and I said, you know, the long view is really valuable in a moment when Americans think nothing like this has ever happened before. What I was, and then David had a really good response to that. What I was thinking of, we emphasize these deep fissures among us and the American, you know, citizenry. We have been here before. I think it's, you know, with these deep, deep divisions, of course, during the Civil War and other times in this country. I think sometimes it's valuable to say there's a book that will tell you how we got through it then and how we may get through it now.
Right. And I don't think you even need to go so far back as the Civil War, for instance. There's a book out this year called American Maelstrom by Michael Cohen, who's a Boston Globe political writer. And it's about the 1968 election and the politics of division at the time. And there you had a sort of fear-mongering candidate stoking white resentment in Wallace, a long-shot lefty, you know, along the lines of Bernie Sanders, who was Eugene McCarthy, and the establishment candidate of Richard Nixon, who in some bizarre ways is was sort of Hillary Clinton this time around. And 68 was brutal,
right,
in some ways, with the conventions, with what was just happening in the country at the time. And I think that was a useful book to think about how, in some ways, even understanding that there are different moments, we have been here before.
Conrad called in to say The Plot Against America by Philip Roth goes back over history. He says it was an exact duplicate of our era. I've actually not read that novel. A renegade comes into a party. David, Carlos, have either of you read that?
I've read it, in fact, and wrote about it when it came out, and in fact wrote a piece on Lit Hub yesterday that references it. I actually think it's a... The literary critic in me is required to say I think it's a deeply flawed novel, but the you know, the political being in me thinks it's incredibly relevant to our moment. The basic setup is that it imagines an alternate history in which Charles Lindbergh runs and wins the Republican nomination in 1940 and is elected, and then ushers in a kind of what I referred to in my piece yesterday as a kind of kinder, gentler fascism, mm-hmm. which is to say an American fascism. Roth, I think the real genius move of the book is that Roth understands that if such a thing were to happen here, it would happen on American terms. It wouldn't be Nazi Germany or Mussolini's Italy, because we do have American institutions. We have a constitution. We have a kind of we have a structure, a social and political structure. So it, you know, so in Roth's imagining, there is discrimination. There are registries and registrations, but there are not mass deportations or work camps or things like that. And one of the things that's most terrifying about that novel is how quickly things become normalized and become couched in this sort of language of the American experiment. And so for that reason, I think it's a really profound cautionary tale.
David, we're hearing a lot of discussion about this idea of normalization right now, aren't we? What do you take from that novel that fits today and the way we're talking about that?
Well, I think what the novel suggests, which seems to me to be true, of human nature, is that we do normalize. That's what we do. The situations that we're in become, you know, we have our own responsibilities, right? We have our families, we have our work lives, we have, you know, we tend to sort of focus on the day-to-day. We do it
right.
In the best of circumstances, we do it in the worst of circumstances. And I think the argument, you know, it's hard to say, I wouldn't actually say that the novel is making a political argument. It's not a piece of Soviet social realism. But, you know, if we can say that the novel is making an argument, it's sort of arguing about the kind of insidious influence of normalization. 6 months after catastrophic event of whatever sort, we have somehow managed to integrate it. Sometimes when that event is a disaster, like, say, 9/11, that's a useful thing in terms of us allowing us to kind of get back to our regular business. When it's a political conflagration, it may not be, normalization may not be such a good thing in the sense that it allows us to feel that we don't have to be involved, or we don't, you know, it allows us to, it encourages a kind of apathy, or can encourage a kind of apathy.
Kathleen says on Twitter, "The Longest Night, it's a historical novel on nuclear age and military life by Andrea Williams." We actually did an interview with Andrea. I think that's an interesting choice here. She says, brilliant female perspective. Peter says, currently rereading Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail by Hunter S. Thompson, but I don't know if that's what you're after. Well, that's an interesting choice, too. And then Heather says, I'm reading The Residence by Kate Brower. Also recommend Louisa, formerly our only foreign-born first lady. Steph, off the page.
Joe says one of the best nonfiction books from 2016 has been Thomas Frank's Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. In the book, Frank described how post-Watergate Democratic partisans divorced the old FDR coalition of intellectuals and working class folks into one focus solely on the intellectuals.
Carlos, will you throw one into the mix here for us and tell me why you're choosing this, whatever it is?
Yes. A couple of things. First, just to follow up on the last person who wrote in about Listen Liberal, I think that is an incredibly prescient book for 2016. There was all this talk earlier in the year about, you know, where will the Republicans go after what many thought would be the inevitable defeat of Donald Trump, and how will the party rethink itself? Well, that conversation is happening with the Democrats now.
So true.
And what Frank Thomas writes about, excuse me, Thomas Frank writes about in Listen Liberal is how the Democratic Party stopped being the party of the working class, and under Clinton, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, it became enthralled with the creative class, with Wall Street, with Silicon Valley, and sort of forgot about workers. And workers now have helped Donald Trump win the presidency. So I think that is a critical book for this year. One thing I want to throw into the discussion with about Philip Roth, I didn't read it at the time when it came out in 2004, 2005, I believe, but I read it this summer for the first time.
Huh.
And I read along with it Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, which is set at the same time period in the 1930s and imagines a populist anti-intellectual leader coming to power who empowers sort of visceral anti-Semitism in the United States. As was said about Philip Roth's novel, I don't think As a novel, I don't think It Can Happen Here is actually anywhere near one of Sinclair Lewis's better novels. But as a political parallel, as a political statement, I think it's very apropos for the moment. If in this kind of dystopian vision of the worst case scenarios of what could come out of a Trump presidency, and both It Can't Happen Here and Plot Against America, I think aside from the parallels you can read or not read to Donald Trump, what I think is more interesting is how people choose to respond. How people either say, look, I'm just going to keep my head down, or I'm going, you know, Canada is this alluring place for Americans in both of these novels. People are all talking about how they're going to go to Canada, and in some cases they try and fail to make that trip. But whether you fight or flee, whether you speak up or keep your head down, whether you resist or even try to accommodate yourself to the new reality, I think those are the most interesting elements and subtexts for us as we read those novels today.
Carlos Lozada with us, if you've just tuned in, from The Washington Post, and David Ulin with us from USC, formerly of the LA Times, and having a conversation this morning about some historical texts, fiction, nonfiction, memoir, biography, that can give us some insight into, maybe spark our imagination a bit, maybe spark some resilience in you if you're a bit dispirited after the election results, or if you're happy about this. Maybe there's a book out there that kind of shows you the way forward with a renegade, as somebody noted, at the helm. If you have a recommendation for us, love to hear that. 651-227-6000. I think we can imagine maybe some of the standard biographies, but maybe there's a novel that speaks to you, as David and Carlos have just recommended. Maybe there's an unexpected memoir that shows you something about these times. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Brittany in Minneapolis. Brittany, it sounds like you have a memoir for us. Good.
I do. It's Coming of Age in Mississippi by Ann Moody.
And tell me why.
She talks about growing up in the state of Mississippi and then going to college and integrating with these white people from the South. And she battles with her prejudice that she faces from the whites that she's working with, and then also her own prejudice against other people that are white because of the way that she was treated growing up.
Is this a memoir, Brittany, that you've recently read, or it's something that you feel like you're now going to go back to?
It's something I'm actually reading currently for an English composition class.
Good. I'm really glad you called with the recommendation. David, it sounds like that struck a chord with you.
I had forgotten about that book. I read it. I read it when it came out, and I agree. It's a fascinating and really heartfelt book, and it does trace both the individual experience of the author, but that navigation of that of that social divide. I was gonna say. I mean, I think that one of the things. First, let me say I completely agree with Carlos about the Lewis, about It Can't Happen Here, which I reread this year. Also, it's certainly not Major Lewis, and once the government gets into place, the book kind of falls apart. But in terms of tracing the campaign and how this sort of know-nothing nativist senator gets elected, it's really prescient in terms of sort of divisions of power and power vacuums and sort of fake populism in a certain sense. So it that's something that's worth looking at. But what I've been thinking about lately is looking at American stories, memoirs, personal narratives, because I think one of the great questions and great challenges facing us as a country right now is how do we start to think about coming together? It is an incredibly divided country, perhaps not so geographically divided as in other eras, certainly as in the Civil War era, but certainly politically and ideologically and emotionally divided. And I think one way, maybe the only way for us to start coming together is to actually listen to each other's stories. A book I'm interested in that I haven't read yet but is on my stack is Hillbilly Elegy.
Oh, yeah.
Which is
a book about that.
I hate to reduce a book on these terms, but it's essentially a book from inside, Trump's America in a certain sense. By the same token, a book I've been talking about for the last 2 years, I think Claudia Rankine's book Citizen is a book that we should be looking at. I think we should be looking at, we shouldn't be doing anything. One thing to think about is to look at sort of a broad and diverse range of individual stories to get back to a sense of what a key element of America, which is diversity. It's a word we throw around, but we don't often actually stop to think about what it means. And I think that's an avenue that's well worth exploring in terms of reading.
For a note for our listeners here, Claudia Rankine was one of our guests on the series that I did right before the election on what it means to be an American. It's funny, David was just kind of channeling that. And it was a really insightful interview. Those interviews went 45 minutes, and I talked to Claudia about this idea of the American identity and where it fits with what she wrote in Citizen. So Steph will tweet out a link on that, and you can always find it on our page, NPR News with Carrie Miller. Carlos, I'm going to throw something at you that's a little sideways here, and it's somebody who I think used to write for The Washington Post. I'm going to suggest Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. And here's why.
Oh, Kate Boo.
Yeah.
Yes.
And here's why. I think the discussion of poverty in this country was, oh my gosh, so one-dimensional during the campaign. But I also want Americans and I want our president-elect to have a better view of what globalization and poverty looks like in another country, India being the one that Kate Boo wrote about. What's your thought on that?
I think it's first of all, just on that book, I think it's a wonderful book. Kate Boo is the kind of writer that when you read her, you just think, why do I even try to be a writer? it's
true.
She really immerses herself so wonderfully into the the lives and experiences of other people, and in a way that doesn't judge, doesn't assume, just tells you their stories. Behind the Beautiful Forever is set in a deep, deep poverty slum in Mumbai. And she tells the story. If you aren't going to read the whole book, she did a terrific piece related to it in The New Yorker that can be also a good start if you want, in which she follows this one little boy around who is trying to collect scraps of metal that then he can sell. And really, it tells you the story of globalization because that was connected to international steel markets and the construction industry as well. I think that kind of story that that describes poverty without trying to preach about it, to convert you, that simply immerses you in the life of somebody else, I think is incredibly valuable. Now, closer to home, one book that I think for me is just the best book I read this year is by a Harvard sociologist named Matthew Desmond. It's called Evicted. And it's set in Milwaukee. And he essentially spent 4 years or so living in communities for whom chronic eviction is a way of life. And I think that I would really recommend it to any listener trying to understand poverty in America, the role that housing plays in poverty in America. And in particular, he's immersed in an African-American community. And black women, I think one of the lines he has in the book is that what mass incarceration has done to black males in the United States, eviction is doing to black women in the United States. Mm. And I think it's probably the best book I've read in a long time on trying to give a new lens on poverty in America.
David, Carlos has just reminded me of a former colleague of yours, I think at the LA Times, Jill Leovi's book, Ghetto Side.
That's an excellent book. And I think in a similar way to what Carlos is describing, it's a book that kind of turns our perceptions by essentially immersing us in personal experience. It's a book that takes place in South Los Angeles, which is a collection of neighborhoods that's often just kind of written off as one amorphous, to use the phrase du jour, inner city area. Mm-hmm. It's seen as a gang, as gang territory. And Leovi was embedded twice for long periods of time with LAPD precinct houses down there, and and went out on calls. And she basically cast into question. She focuses on two particular murders, one of them involving the son of a police officer, that are characterized as gang shootings because, well, in the case of the officer's son, the victim was mistaken as a gang member because of a hat he was wearing, and it gets into this whole question of how we categorize things and how we use categories to not think about what's going on, and also into the very complicated and politically loaded question of policing and how much is enough or whether more is necessary and what is the relationship of the police to the community. She's a spectacular reporter. I say this not just because I worked with her for many years, but really, really spectacular reporter who does the work. I mean, she worked on that, reported that book for years before she even began to write. And she challenges our preconceptions, which I think is what great nonfiction can do. I think also, but, reflecting back on what Carlos was saying, it's the personal stories. And I don't want to reduce everything to the personal, but I do think that's where empathy comes in and that's where understanding comes in. It's a lot easier for us, certainly for me as a reader, to wrap my mind around or understand complex social and political issues if I'm approaching them through lives. And so I think that that's something that she does quite well in this book, is really draw us into the lives of everybody, police, community members, families, etc. We really have a personal stake in the outcome.
Anna says on Twitter, Teacher Man by Frank McCourt. I think there's empathy in that memoir, too. Matthew says, 10 Days That Shook the World speaks to power of journalism to capture the craziness, disorder, an energy of a chaotic time. Steph, off the page.
Lori said, I just finished reading Letters from America by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I was avoiding reading it for months, knowing it would bring me down. Now I'm down. I might as well explore how bad things are, she says.
And to the phones to Lewis in Minneapolis. Lewis, thanks so much for waiting. We have a lot of calls here, and I appreciate the time from you. What do you want to suggest?
Oh, hi, Carrie. I want to thank you for your show. I've probably been listening for over a decade now, and
thank
wow.
You.
The broad range of topics, I love it. I'm purposely set out to read a book right now. It's called Cicero, with the subtitle The Life and Times of Rome's Greatest Politicians. There's certainly a lot of parallels.
I love this
about
suggestion.
Empire, and you want to see something that makes our political time look tame. It certainly is. And I think Donald Trump has introduced the element of baseness into our politics, which Rome had. They were based and barbaric, but yet they were very sophisticated. And I think you see that in our situation now as well. And as far as empire, the only thing that really can bring an empire down is itself. So Rome brought itself down. And if we're not careful, we might be on that road. Mm.
Lewis, thanks very much for the recommendation. It's good.
Can I say something about
yes,
Cicero?
Please
for a
do.
Second?
Yeah.
I think it's fortuitous that he mentioned Cicero. One of my colleagues here at the Post just recently wrote a story about how Donald Trump is basically the Cicero of the 2016 campaign, in the sense of, you know, Cicero was this famous orator and wrote books about rhetoric and rhetorical devices, and a lot of the things that he would do. Trump has really done. I don't know if he was consciously channeling Cicero. But for instance, one thing that Cicero would often do and wrote about as a technique is to say that you're not going to say something, right? Cicero would talk about his political opponents and say, I will not speak of his drunken revels. I will not speak of the murders he has committed. You know, and you saw Trump doing that very
absolutely.
Overtly during the campaign. You know, I could say something about Hillary, but I'm not going to. If I did, it would be huge, you know. And there's, you know, reading Cicero's book on the orator is sort of a weird funhouse mirror version of seeing some of the techniques that Donald Trump deployed in his speech making, in his very idiosyncratic forms of speech making.
Lewis has just added yet another book to the very top of my towering stack of books, but I appreciate the recommendation. Such a good one. To Carol in St. Paul. Hi, Carol. What are you thinking about?
Hi. I'm thinking of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America by Nancy Eisenberg. A brilliant, brilliant book confronting a topic that we have buried in denial for 200 and some years in this country. And this goes right back to day one of the Jamestown settlement and through Plymouth Rock, the whole deal, the Mayflower, what was going on in terms of permanent class structure. The democracy was not intended for the whole population. It was really, you know, the Greek model or whatever of the elites, political elites, the political citizens, the landowners, the et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
but
Carol, thank you.
That model has held right up until now, and the reaction to it has been building, of course, and has its little victories here and there.
Carol, I appreciate the recommend. Yeah, thank you so much. We have so many people I'd still want to try to get to. Carlos, I think I heard you say, oh, yes. Did you review and read that book for
yes.
the Post?
Yes, I did. There's this sort of trilogy of books that people are referring to as, you know, the books that explain the Trump support in the white working class. One is Hillbilly Elegy, as we mentioned. Another is Strangers in Their Own Land by Arlie Russell Hochschild. White Trash, I think, is the strongest of the three.
Okay.
It's by an LSU historian who looks at the long history of white rural outcasts in America and how, you know, politicians from Andrew Jackson to Donald Trump have tried to rally them, but who have often remained shunned, mocked, both in the public imagination and physically. You know, and it goes back to how the British tried to send their surplus poor to America, you know, and people they were trying to get rid of sometimes. And the attitude was transplanted to American elites here. I mean, George Washington at one point said, you know, I just really want to have the lower class of people serve as foot soldiers. Thomas Jefferson wanted to import German immigrants, try to like improve the stock and the work ethic of the farmers and laborers. And it's really a terrific tale that goes all the way to sort of our cultural attitudes toward the white working class. She talks about, for instance, the Ewell family in To Kill a Mockingbird. Right. This is the American literature's like purest distillation of what according to the title of the book, right, is referred to as kind of white trash America. And I think it's a very important book for this particular moment when suddenly we're rediscovering this group as worthy of sociology and of cable hits, you know. And I think White Trash, of the trilogy that has come forward, is really the one to read.
On Twitter here, a listener says, I appreciate the book list, but what do we do about people not reading? Isn't that group a big part of Trump supporters? David, I'm going to say not just of Trump supporters. Americans are not reading enough fiction. Maybe you could suggest a couple of novels to bring some people back into reading here.
Well, I mean, I think we're reading more than people think, but I think we're never reading enough. You know, I mean, I've never been a sort of proponent of the idea that the death of reading idea. But yes, there certainly are faster, sexier distractions than sitting alone with a book for several hours. I think in terms of fiction, I would start with the book that won the National Book Award for Fiction last night, which
excellent.
Is Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad, which I think is a really excellent, challenging, at times extremely brutal and disturbing novel that deals, you know, with that deals with America's racial history, among other things. I think he's a beautiful writer and a gorgeous thinker, and I think the novel is both a novel as story, but also is a novel that is provocative in terms of what it's addressing. You know, the other thing that I would suggest, it's not a novel, but I've been thinking about this over the last week or so, is going back to some of the founding documents, by which I don't necessarily only mean the Constitution and the Declaration, although those are always useful to look at. But, you know, about 20 or so years ago, the Library of America put out a 2-volume set called The Debate on the Constitution, which is essentially almost a documentary in print of the sort of discussions, public discussions, unfolding largely in newspapers about the Constitutional Convention and arguments as ratification. It includes the Federalist Papers, but rather than pulling them aside as the Federalist Papers, it sort of publishes them in context as they appeared. You know, it's fascinating. It's 1,800 pages, so not for everyone, but worth dipping into, because what it reminds us, and I think it's really important to keep this in mind, is that history is not inevitable. It's conditional. Things always could have gone either way or multiple ways. We look back on it in hindsight and think, oh, this was sort of almost kind of preordained. But I'm really interested in that question of living history. We're always living through a moment of living history. We're certainly living through a big moment of living history right now, not just in terms of the United States, but globally. And so I find that context is always really, really useful. And I know that there's a kind of resistance to reading 200-year-old writers, which is a resistance I often share, but these are pieces that were written for the popular press for the most part. So they are, you know, they're witty, they're accessible, they're pointed, they're provocative. And so I that's something that I've been thinking about over the last week, is sort of those kinds of founding documents and founding discussions.
David Carlos, thank you so much for the recommendations and for the insight on so many of the books that were mentioned. I hope you'll come back and do it again sometime.
Anytime.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Carlos Lozada with us, nonfiction book critic at The Post, and David Ulan, formerly of the LA Times and a professor of English at USC. I got a tweet here, Steph, from Jonathan, who says, is anyone keeping a full list of all the books recommended on the show?
Yes.
The amazing Stephanie Curtis is doing just that. Were you able to catch all that?
I've caught almost everything.
Oh my gosh,
maybe there's something
good.
I missed.
You're good.
And then Tracy Mumford is also writing up a lovely looking one that will be up later today.
This is going to, this reading list will take you through the end of the year, all the way through the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays and right into the end of the year. So get reading. Read harder.